Hello and welcome to National League Town, Mets fandom, Mets history, Mets life, with Long Island's own Greg Prince and Jeff Heisen. Hey, Greg.
Ahoy, Jeff. New season. Oh, my God.
On today's show, we look ahead to the season and remember a world champion Met. But first, columnist Tom Boswell wrote that time begins on opening day. I love that, because as of today, we are on Mets time. For the next 6, or hopefully 7 months, instead of thinking, I have nothing planned for today, we can say the Mets have a game today. We will go to sleep with thoughts of the last game and wake up with hopes for the next one. We've been waiting for it since last October, or maybe August. The season is here. We are now on Mets time. Greg, how do you feel? Are you excited?
I am surprised that Mets time has arrived so soon. I know it's 6 months between seasons. Yet, as I get older, it feels like it kind of sneaks up on me. I've managed to fill my days between seasons and have all kinds of ambitions and plans that I never seem to completely get around to. So it's like, oh, the season's here now. That changes my days. But since when does a Mets fan not look forward to the new Mets season, regardless of what that season looks like? So to not be excited, quite frankly, would be to be dead. And I'm alive.
We talked last year about the weight of expectations coming off a frustrating playoff series and our high hopes for the season. While we have hopes, if you don't have high hopes on opening day, you're never going to have it. But Steve Cohen said that success would be making the playoffs. That certainly is a big change. Did you find that comment to be realistic or Wolponian?
I think success is whatever works that day as an answer for this team at this moment. From what I've gleaned listening to Cohen, listening to Stearns, David Stearns, that is, listening to others connected to the organization, I think they're all very taken by the idea that all you need is 84 wins, which is to say the Arizona Diamondbacks of 2023. The fact that the Arizona Diamondbacks kind of got dragged into the playoffs or snuck in, you know, they won 84 games, which until a few years ago was very rarely a playoff-worthy figure. But now, you know, 3 wild cards make it from each league. So there seems to be some thought on the Mets side that, hey, we can do that, you know, get a little lucky. And before you know it, we're in the playoffs. And like the Diamondbacks, you can make a run and turn that into something big or in a chance for the biggest. And you should be able to picture yourself winning 84 games on the precipice of a season unless you've completely torn it down, which I don't think the Mets have. What did they win last year? 75 games. Again, you don't know that 84 is going to be the number. I think the year before it was like 89 maybe when the Phillies were the final team in. So I'm glad that the Mets are thinking about the playoffs as opposed to using euphemisms like we just want to be competitive. I think that was Wolponian. It's not the same as saying, you know, we won't be satisfied until we win it all, that sort of thing, which also never really works because how are you going to make that happen by talking about it? One of the things, when the wild card came into being in the 90s, sort of came up with a philosophy that what you do as a team is aim for first place. And if you don't make it, you've got a fallback. In those days, just one second place team made the playoffs. So I'm a little wary of the idea of we're aiming for a wild card. We're aiming for essentially 84 wins or something within that range. You know, I always come back to, I hope they go 1-0 every night, every day. But the fact that they're not just saying, you know, we want to see what our team has and we want to compete sort of, that's nice. But again, they have tickets to sell. They have interest to stoke. I don't think it's a lost cause going into it. Like you said, what's the point of thinking your season's a lost cause a couple of days before the opener? So we know some of these players. We've lived with some of these players. Others are new to us. not as new to you, having been in spring training for a while, and I'm sure having compiled your Jeff Heisen All-Stars, but they will be new in terms of being the Mets. And there's the mystery. And there's the mystery for every club, because everybody, from the world champion Texas Rangers to the, I think, first draft pick Oakland A's. I don't know if they actually have the first draft pick, but I think they had the worst record last year and may not even be in Oakland, as we've talked about. Everybody's new this year. It's all clean slate. So whatever they say because you kind of have to put up a good front, I think. I think it would not be good if you just came in and said, you know what, we have some nice things at the ballpark, and you ought to come out because it'll be sunny and warm. You got to say something.
And we'll get to those nice things soon. But Fangraphs has the Mets winning 81. Baseball Prospectus's PECOTA standings have the Mets winning 84. As you touched on, Greg, the problem with that attitude, well, let's just get in and we'll take it from there, is that that's a low bar. And 84 could easily become 82 if the ball goes one way and not the other way. 84 could easily go 86. You want to be a fan of a team that's expected to win the World Series. 84 seems like a low bar, and a lot of other teams can reach that bar too.
Yeah, I get the feeling that this front office in particular and this ownership kind of thinks, and maybe they are. Maybe they know a lot. We know that the kinds of things Steve Cohen does in his other life. We know David Stearns' background, that there's an analytical answer here. We can figure out how many wins it's going to take and how to get them and what it's going to get us. And it never really seems to work. But if they're close to it in their minds, if they've looked up and down the league and decided, you know what, that there is enough wiggle room within what was last year. Once you got beneath the top layer of the National League, a lot of mediocrity. And we were at the lower end of the mediocrity. And we talked about more than once, the possibility that we could have crept up and made some noise. And then if you're making noise, then, suddenly the clamor leads you into that playoff spot. On the other hand, if they came out and said, we think we have a world champion here, 718507 TIXX, that would be disingenuous. We know what they did at the trade deadline last year, peeled off their megastars for prospects. And for the most part, we were okay with that. And we have been okay with that. And I think we'll continue to be okay with that. There's just the messy little matter in between. Kind of thrown in the towel in 2023 and reshaping, if not rebuilding, for say 2026 is a messy little matter of 2024 right now. And yet you don't want to say, it's not much of a season ahead. And you can't really say, wow, based on what they've done in the offseason with one very late, very notable exception that I'm sure we'll get to. They haven't done a whole lot to make it seem as if this is a team with any kinds of aspirations beyond getting through the season. But again, I keep coming back to you get through the season and you do it kind of competently with this playoff format. At the very least, you have a reason to track the standings every day and you can aspire. And yeah, your aspirations for fill in the blank wins might read differently in August and September than they do now, because you'll kind of figure, well, if we could just be ahead of this team and that team, suddenly it's looking good. But it's again, blank slate. I'll be curious to see how the slate begins to fill in. And I can say again, I'm feeling, wow, it's gonna fill in great, but I'm curious. I'm curious to see what happens.
You talk about a lot of mediocrity, and Steve Cohen, we're on a first name basis on NLT. Steve said there are only two super teams in the National League. Of course, he's talking about the Braves and the Dodgers, and the Mets are with everybody else. I'm not sure if the Phillies would object to Steve's statement, but I get where he's coming from. And I think that may have driven the acquisition of JD Martinez, because the Giants and the Padres improved themselves during spring training, while the Mets hadn't. And those two teams are the Mets' competitors for the wild cards. And I'll be making my predictions shortly, but I don't see the Mets competing with the Braves this year. And of course, now they're 0-0. But eventually the Braves will peel off and head to the top of the standings, and we'll be looking for the Giants and the Padres and the Diamondbacks as our competitors, and other teams, perhaps the Cubs and the Reds, for the second and third wild cards. So it's going to have a different feel this year. We're not just going to be looking in Atlanta and Philadelphia, we'll be looking across the country.
The Mets have got to look at the Milwaukee Brewers on day one and the Detroit Tigers on day four and all of that sort of thing. It's always, I think, dangerous. Certainly dangerous if you're the team looking ahead. I think it's, dangerous is too strong a word, but I don't think you're doing yourself any favors as a fan trying to game the board. Again, who made the playoffs last year? The Diamondbacks. I don't know how many people were expecting them. The Marlins. I don't know if anybody was expecting them. We can on a positive historical note, we're doing this in some bizarre time warp where podcasting exists 55 years ago. Nobody's picking the Mets to finish in first place in the newly formed National League East of 1969. So there are always surprises, always teams that will reach above their station that you're not seeing, who made moves that didn't seem like anything in December or some really small pickup in January. And suddenly, wow, they're doing really well. And team like the 2023 New York Mets that did not do as well as expected and became apparent pretty early. So I am hoping that internally they know what they're doing. And of course, externally on the field, of course, we hope they not only know what they're doing, but make it happen. I was very happy when they got JD Martinez. I was willing to go along with the organizational school of thought, the one they put out there, that was, well, we want to see what our young players can do. And I probably would have nodded along right to opening day with Mark Vientos as the DH, despite my reservations about young players being DHs. But there's a superb hitter just sitting on the market and sitting and sitting and sitting. I don't know if everybody's seen this one particular commercial that, quite frankly, annoys the hell out of me, but it's for an app that helps you sell your car. And it's a husband and wife going on about whether this is the moment to sell their car. Then the wife keeps going, hold, hold, hold. And at last, he sees the price move and says, now. And they sell the car, and everything's great. And you should have this app and use it, according to the commercial. That's what it felt like with JD Martinez. They waited and waited and waited, and the market left him there. And they didn't have to make an enormous commitment to him in terms of years or dollars and what dollars there were. They deferred a lot of them. And it doesn't necessarily block the path of somebody like Mark Vientos. And it says, you know what? We could have used more offense in our lineup. We went out and got some because no matter how you frame your expectations for 2024, you say this is a year to get to know the young players and move them along. You still want to win games every single night. And I think one extra hitter can make a difference. And this is an accomplished hitter. And it was kind of odd. As soon as it happened, it was kind of odd to think, why didn't they do this? I mean, he won't be ready for opening day. He has to take some at bats in the minor leagues and get into shape. And he might not even be ready, 10 days in, whatever the rule is. But he'll be here eventually. And you hope that got plenty left. He's 36. And I know, came off a good year, come off a lot of good years. If I can just throw in quickly one precedent for this that's not that long ago, but I imagine a lot of people have forgotten he was ever here. Remember Adrian Gonzalez? Adrian Gonzalez was a tremendous hitter who had tailed off prior to 2018. The Mets picked him up. And what was the subtext of that? Well, we were looking at Dom Smith, our hot new first base prospect, had a little experience, but we're bringing Gonzalez, and Gonzalez is going to teach him how to be a better hitter, and he's going to share his wisdom. In the meantime, he's going to hit. I don't remember a whole lot of that coming to fruition. I'm sure Gonzalez Eldon Smith, whatever their conversations were, or at least attempted to. Never read there was any tension or friction. Smith eventually got at bats, and Gonzalez had a few hits, then stopped having a few hits, moved on, and life went on. So I'm just saying that these sorts of things occasionally do happen, and you kind of feel as a long-term fan that you've lived through everything, except with different names, you're living through them again. But that's not a reason not to do it. I liked it. I like the fact that they're trying to step up a little bit. And if they think this is the difference between the Mets kind of fumfering along and getting valuable experience, but not really being a team that's going to contend versus, you know what, we have a puncher's chance, to use that cliche. Why not take a punch or deliver a punch, I should say. You know, we've taken enough punches. And as far as Mark Vientos or anybody like that, prove it. Keep proving it. You'll find your way back. We know how rosters are. We know everybody bounces up and down as long as they're on the 40-man roster for the most part. I took it as probably the most, along with Edwin Diaz coming back, the most delightful sign of spring.
I was surprised because of the timing. We talked about it on our last show, and we've been thinking about J.D. Martinez for months. And then my son texts me and says, finally. And that was the entire text. So I had to figure out what he was talking about. But I'm glad it happened. I just wish it had happened sooner. We were told that J.D. Martinez is a hitting savant. Well, they lost a month of his savantness in camp because he could have been savanting, not real words, with the younger players and teaching them all his savant-like skills. They lost that, and they're going to lose him for part of the season, and maybe these one or two games that he's not there, it will make a difference in the standings. But they were waiting for his price to go down. We don't know how good Mark Vientos can be. I'm thinking he could be as good as J.D. Martinez. We don't know that. But we know that J.D. Martinez will be as good as J.D. Martinez. And that's why it's the right move. I just wish they had made it a few days earlier.
Yeah, he'll probably be as good as J.D. Martinez will probably be as good as J.D. Martinez. Age always concerns me. Injuries always concern me. But the guy hit. Guy's been hitting for years. As far as Vientos turning into that kind of hitter, let's remember J.D. Martinez wasn't J.D. Martinez at the beginning of his career. It took him a little while to get going. With any luck, players have long careers. We've seen flashes with Vientos. We saw, I think, 5 home runs during spring training. Yeah, I was ready for him. Sometimes you just say, you know what? The guy's there. It's worth a shot. As far as the waiting, there'll be a week of games where you'll never get them. You'll never get them back. And you don't know. Maybe whoever's filling in for 7 days will make it difficult to suddenly say, hey, J.D. Martinez is taking your job. But I understand that there are luxury tax considerations and all that stuff in the weeds that they probably wanted to avoid. I don't think it's so much a matter of Steve Cohn worrying that he couldn't afford J.D. Martinez. But, you know, they do operate in a Major League Baseball framework where it's not simply, even though sometimes it feels like it, it's not simply a matter of throwing money at players. But I'm with you. He's an upgrade. He's an improvement. So, yes, to quote Dylan, finally.
You mentioned the Jeff Eisen Spring Training All-Stars. And before we define what that was, watching from New York, did any Mets stand out to you in spring training other than the big names?
I don't know that I was really taken by anybody. I think I have a mechanism within me when the names aren't that familiar to sort of lower my level of processing. I kept a list all winter long because I felt like I was not going to remember them because there weren't any Justin Verlanders in there, if you know what I mean, trying to remember who we got. So occasionally I'd perk up and say, oh, that's Zach Shorten. Oh, that's Joey Wendell. And, oh, you know, those are the one of the many, many relief pitchers we got. I can't say I had like a Butch Husky moment. If you anybody remembers this, although Butch Husky was already had a couple of hash marks on him as a major leaguer, he had this huge spring training going into 1996. One of the best spring trainings any Met has ever had. And you know, my tongue was practically hanging out at the end of spring training to see Butch Husky do what he could do in the major leagues with a full season behind him. And, you know, he was okay. I don't think there was anybody like that. But again, I don't know that I was looking. You mentioned the big names. I mean, the names to me, I mentioned Edwin Diaz. That to me was the one spine-tingling moment of the spring, him coming into a game for the first time. It felt real, more so than just a practice game. And the one guy I watched with some interest, investment, was Starling Marte, who for the longest time I felt was just flying out to center every single at bat until this weekend. where I was happy to stop thinking things like, I wonder if he's going to retire like Michael Kadire did after 1 year, which, I have to be, be careful not to make snap judgments or even spring judgments. So to as one of my long answers to your question, no, nobody really jumped out at me, but I don't watch these games with quite the focus you do. So, again, for the folks who don't know Jeff Heisen All-Stars, to me, and I coined the phrase years ago, to me, Jeff Heisen All-Stars are when my friend goes to spring training and gets excited about guys who seem kind of marginal at the time, who may prove themselves and turn into real contributors to the Mets season ahead, or we may never hear from them again, but that's just baseball. But I appreciate that you pay attention. So tell me about your All-Stars if you have them.
I do. And first of all, I want to thank everybody that listened to Grapefruit League Town, which was the rebranding, as Greg put it, of this show during my month in Florida. There are 12 episodes that still remain out there, 12 episodes equaling 91 minutes, because I didn't have Greg to talk to. So it was just me. There's some episodes are 5 minutes. But I hope you find those worthwhile. I thank everybody that listened. The Jeff Heisen's.
Very nice job, by the way.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Jose Iglesias stood out to me at first. He will be a AAA. He accepted an assignment. He's not a kid. He's been on major league teams before. And at the beginning of spring training, he stood out. And I was very impressed with him. My Jeff Heisen spring training all-star MVP was Zach Short. And he made the team, which surprised me because to an extent, he's redundant with Joey Wendell, who had a major league contract. And I'm not saying this because I stood at the Cacti Ballpark of the Palm Beaches next to Zach Short's Sacred Heart teammate, because I didn't know who that was, but he yelled Shorty. And I was like, that's insulting to somebody who's vertically challenged. But he said Shorty, and Zach Short looked up, and they talked for a few minutes. And then when he left, I asked how he knew Zach Short. And I said, you think he's going to make the team? And he sadly shook his head. But over the month, he not only fielded well at second, third, and yes, short, but he hit well. He hit for power. It was very impressive. And I'm glad he made the team. Well, we don't know how long he will be around. Same with DJ Stewart, both of whom are on the team as of this recording on Monday. I was very pleased to see that Zach Short made the team. We've talked about some of the people who will be on the team at Citi Field on Thursday or whenever opening day happens, depending on the weather. But Greg, you were at Citi Field for What's New at Citi Field Day. And I think the people want to know, what was your reaction to the dance team?
Everybody dance now, gonna make you sweat. I wish they had made me sweat because it was like 30 degrees with the wind chill. And the wind chill is important here because where they had them performing was in the left field corner on the field level, which I'm sure they thought out very well. They needed a spot to give them some space. And oh, we have a whole ballpark here. Let's go where the wind blows in. I'm sure nobody was expecting late March to feel like early March or early January. Putting that aside, the dance team, the Queen's Crew, as they are known, it's hard for me to be critical because I was standing literally right next to a few of them, both as they were getting ready to go on, and then later we were taken upstairs. It's like a mob of people at this thing. It was a media event as well as maybe some sponsors, and I don't know who all was there, but a lot of people. So kind of crowded into various areas with the dancers. When you're sitting in the promenade and ladies and gentlemen, the Queen's Crew, you might be tempted to give them grief if you're not into it. But I've seen them. They're young people and they're smiling and it's like, and they're wearing orange and blue. And I was rooting for them. See how I'm feeling in July. But the Mets are trying a lot of different things around the edges, probably with the idea that we're not selling a championship caliber team this year. Maybe we'll get lucky, but the way things look now is a lot different from it looked a year ago, where although they had this event last year and introduced that humongous scoreboard or video board, there was also that sense of, remember there was a Super Bowl commercial last year, at least in the New York market. They aired it during the Super Bowl and aired it throughout the spring of Brandon Nimmo and Edwin Diaz taking your phone calls to buy tickets. And wasn't this exciting? Because look at these Mets. They're just so great. And you just want to see them. I don't have that this year. It's about propping up the experience. The experience is coming to see dancers. The experience is new LED lighting. the experience is a new team store. One thing that should be of interest to people like us is when you go into the Rotunda and you visit the Hall of Fame, the Hall of Fame won't be there. But don't worry, the Hall of Fame has not gone away. They've expanded that space to be part of the team store. It's a much more negotiable, navigable team store. It always felt pretty cramped to me. If anybody remembers the very first season of City Field when there was no Hall of Fame, that was retail space. It's retail space again. It's like the Forest has reclaimed an urban area that has been neglected. But don't worry, there's still a Hall of Fame. They are putting the plaques up on the pillars. When you ride up the escalator from the Rotunda, you see you will be greeted by immortality. When you go out to center right field, that whole Fan Fest area, which you may recall years past had things like the dunk tank, or the kiddie field. There's an area, we didn't go there that day, but I believe it's in that area where they've had various lounges and shops. Now we're going to be the Hall of Fame. So you can visit it if you're walking along, you want to step in, see the Hall of Fame while you're kind of within the ballpark, as opposed to making a special trip downstairs. It's there. I don't know what that's going to mean in terms of foot traffic or for general Mets history consciousness, which I'm a big fan of. But, you know, they did go out of their way to talk about it. So I take that as a good sign. Things like the expanded retail space, things like new premium seating. You'll actually see blue seats for a couple of rows. Imagine that, a team whose one of whose colors is blue, using blue seats. We did part of this tour in one of the, I won't call it fancy, but you know, one of the upscale clubs, or at least for if you have super tickets, which looked very nice. I don't know that I'll ever get to see it again, unless I get lost. But a lot of this was, quite frankly, to take your money, or to make you want to spend it. And that's what major league and professional sports teams do. I understand that they're trying to put together more of an experience. I think it's in general, like around the edges of Citi Field. And I mean that, you know, figuratively as well as literally. It's neat. It's great that they're doing this. It's great that the ballpark, which is now in its 16th season, doesn't feel old. It feels lived in. And I was taken by the fact that as we walked as part of this tour from where they first had us downstairs, showing us this club and giving us a presentation in the press conference room, up to the left field, freezing, windy spot, you realize that, oh, this is all very familiar. This is lived in. I think there's a tendency among us old timers to kind of think of Citi Field as the new ballpark. It's a little misleading to do this, but 16 years of Shea Stadium meant 1978. And by then, Shea Stadium did not seem new at all. 2024, 16th year of Citi Field, doesn't seem new, but it doesn't seem, wow, they really got to start thinking about fixing this place up. They've done it here and there, little by little along the way, and it still feels fresh. So that was nice to see. I was more interested in just that vibe and that aura than I was necessarily of what great new stores do they have or whatever. And the tour ended with food, which I'm not going to lie, is a nice thing, especially when you don't have to pay for it. They were showing off the many different vendors they will have, different concessions, some things available to everybody, some things that will be in some of these clubs, and all the restaurateurs and chefs were there representing their establishments, many of whom were Queens-based, you know, local people they're working with, which is always nice to see. I think I tried 8 different things, which is an insane amount of things to try for lunch, because I don't eat 8 different things for lunch every day. I'm lucky if I remember to eat one thing for lunch every day. And these were samples, but they were not insubstantial. And I realized I am doing things I shouldn't tell my doctor about in terms of what I was eating, but it was very good. I'll just throw in a plug here. Mama's Empanadas, if you see them, Citi Field this year, go for it. I don't know how much it'll be. It's an empanada. How much could it be, even in the world of ballparks? They've always prided themselves on good food. They reminded us that readers and ballpark people voted Citi Field the best when it came to food, ballpark food, in 2023, and they're defending their crown. It was fun to be back at the ballpark and not have to sit in those 30-degree wind chills. Standing there for 5 minutes while other people danced, I could take. They're talented kids, the dancers. And I just hope that the music isn't too loud.
Yeah, they're not doing it for us. We want to talk between innings, and they didn't do this for us. But have you ever gone to a game and you went home and your wife asked, "How the Mets doing?" You said, "They won." And she said, "You must have had a great time." And you said, "It was okay. I just wish there were dancers."
Few times, sure. Well, maybe the I wish somebody had made a balletic double play around second base. The old 6-4-3 ballet, that would have been nice. No, I've never really wanted that. Listen, we've both, I'm sure, been to professional basketball games. There's a lot of dancing during timeouts, dance teams, cheerleaders doing routines during football games. It's not unheard of. Baseball, again, there's so many things we always kind of felt set baseball apart, and we always took a little innate pride in that without even thinking of it. And now you think back to mascots 45 years ago, putting aside our love for Mr. Met. This was when Mr. Met was sort of on hiatus, when he was a logo on the rain check. You didn't really see Mr. Met hanging around Shea Stadium, but you were getting the San Diego Chicken, which begat the Philly Fanatic, which begat Fred Bird and the Pirate Parrot. And for about 5 minutes, I believe his name was Dandy at Yankee Stadium, and that did not last. And at the time, it was like, what is baseball messing around with mascots for? It's baseball. Well, mascots are still around. Some have come, some have gone. And Mr. Met had a rebirth, which I think we all enjoy. So there are things that just feel like they're not baseball oriented, but become kind of baseball oriented. I don't know that the Queens Crew will take off if people will just be super into it. I'm thinking back now, you mentioned the dancing. They used to do things between innings where, hey, show us your dancing on the Diamond Vision. And they would have fans get up on the top of the dugout or just in at their seats or whatever, and people would watch it and applaud maybe if they were in a good mood if the Mets were winning, or you would ignore it. I don't think I need sensory overload between innings. I do like conversations between innings. If this takes the place of one what amounts to a commercial between innings, I'll consider that a slight upgrade. I'm sure this is going to be sponsored by somebody, and if it isn't already, and that this, we're not really going to bucolic settings anymore for baseball games. I think it's like I was just saying about the season itself. We're going to have to see what it's like. I'm trying to give these hardworking kids the benefit of the doubt. They performed in the cold. Some of the girls wore midriffs or bare midriffs. I'm like, oh, you poor thing. I wish you were covered up. Just worried about you getting frostbite. Do I need it? No. Is it for me or you? No. Might we, at the end of the season, say we have so much to be proud of, like Mr. Met and the Queens Crew? I don't know. But those are people. So I'm going to try to give them the benefit of the doubt. I don't know how much of an idea it is. If it's just one of those things we talk about 5 years from now, if we're all still around and say, hey, remember that year they had the Queens Crew? Wasn't that ridiculous? Chalk one up for experience.
Did the relocation of the plaques and the artifacts bother you as an historian? Was it like, well, we got to put them somewhere, so we want to sell merch, but we got to put these nice things somewhere because we don't want to be forgetful of Mets history, so we'll put them here and there. Did you find that to be insulting to Mets history, or is it okay with you?
I think ultimately I'm going to have to see what it looks like. Funny thing is, as our group is heading up the escalator from the rotunda to walk out to freezing left field, I had run into a friend of mine and we were deep in conversation. We're two people who are really into the Hall of Fame stuff, and we forgot to look for the plaques to see what they looked like. I don't know how many people will stop to look as they're on their way to their seats. I don't know how many people, after a while, stopped into the Hall of Fame. I mean, you always had a nice little stream of people, it seemed to me, especially early in seasons. It always felt a little static to me after what it started in 2010 and it was there in that spot for 14 seasons. I like knowing where it is. I like knowing it was practically at the front door. I like the fact that they would change up one main exhibit year after year, but then it kind of would sit there all year long. And sometimes I would go in before catching my train to, oh, I want to see something that I may have forgotten about, and it would be empty. So I think I, knowing how this organization is working now, and not just on the baseball side of things. I think they did their homework. And the fact that they even mentioned it and put it in the press packets that they sent out afterwards shows me that they're at least paying attention. You got to remember, this is an organization under previous ownership where they just plumb forgot to put in a Hall of Fame the first year and acted as if, oh, yeah, we'll get around to it. And I was shocked in 2010 to show up and see it there. And I've always thought it's a nice space. I hope that having it within the parameters of the ballpark where there is at least foot traffic will lead some people in there. Again, you know, in an ideal world, none of us are getting up from our seats in the third inning to wander around, but people do get up to wander around. They're putting it in a fairly busy spot as opposed to separating it out. Ideally, I like if they move the retail and get a bigger Hall of Fame. I've got lots of ideas I would share with them to make the New York Mets Hall of Fame and Museum a showpiece unto itself. You go to some places like Cincinnati, it's a separate building next to the ballpark and they do all kinds of things. That would be fantastic. But I understand you like to sell merch. I have found the store, the main team store on the Rotunda level up to this point, kind of unpleasant's a strong word, but not a happy experience. It's a very cramped until this year place. They've redone some things. The cash registers, to use a 20th century word that doesn't apply anymore, are going to be, you know, right outside in the rotunda, not taking up the whole rotunda, but the idea that, you know, you'll scan your card or whatever, and it won't be a whole thing. You know, they say it'll work faster. At least that's the idea. We're deep into another era where that sort of thing is concerned. And it's a very nice looking store, by the way, now. It's a brighter, sunnier, again, we can get you in the mood to buy, I suppose. But people do like team stores. I like team stores. I don't always like the prices, but I do like the merchandise and do like the opportunity to get stuff, at least be surrounded by it. So I understand why they did it. I'm not shocked. I'm almost shocked that it's taken this long. But I will have to see what the new Hall of Fame experience looks like and see how much more of things are around the ballpark. I'll have to, you know, in these spaces down again, admittedly, for people who have, you know, the really nice tickets, the really nice plans, there's a lot of memorabilia and just Metsiana down there, which is really nice to see, as opposed to just seeing, say, a sponsor's logo and just forgetting that this is a ballpark. It's really a different world than it was in 2009, where Citi Field is concerned, where that aspect of it is concerned. So I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt since I didn't get to see every inch of the place on the day of the event, which was last week.
The Mets released their beer list for the season. So I consulted my beer expert, my older son. If you listen to Grapefruit League Town, he gave us his opinion of the beer selection at Roger Dean Chevrolet Stadium and at Clover Park. So I sent him the list of beers that will be served at Citi Field this season. But before I tell you what he said, the problem is that not everything is everywhere. So that during a game, I like to sit in my seat and watch the game. I'm not going to go from the 500 level to the 200 level for a superior brew. That's to me an issue with having a fine beer list. Having said this, my son, first of all, noted that Coors and Miller High Life were listed under craft beer, and he called that ridiculous. And he said he hasn't sampled every beer on the list, which surprised me, but he did point out two beers for your attention, Sloop and Threes. I don't know where they'll be at the ballpark. I will look for them when Greg and I go for the Daryl Strawberry retirement number ceremony. But Sloop and Threes were my older son's beer of choice. Have you had Sloop or Threes?
I have not had Sloop or Threes. I'm not a huge beer drinker. I had a taste of a rum drink at this food portion of the event, only because there were nice people with trays with little plastic cups. And I'm thinking, should I? What the heck? wasn't a good idea because it's before noon. I'm not used to drinking. I very rarely have anything like this, maybe when I was in college or something. And I haven't been in college for a while. I hope people enjoy, drink responsibly. I'm sure somebody at some point, I know that somebody at some point in the history of Miller Brewing and somebody in the history of Coors Brewing crafted beer. So if that's your definition for craft beer, sure, put it on the menu. There are people who like everything. I'm sure there'll be plenty of, much like there's plenty of merchandise to separate you from your hard-earned dollars. There'll be plenty of beer, plenty of food for it, and hopefully it's worth it.
Before we give our predictions for the season, I want to see how Greg reacts to something that's happening in real time. Greg, the Mets today announced that they will wear a tribute uniform patch all season to honor Mets Hall of Famer Bud Harrelson. Harrelson passed away earlier this year. We spoke about it on the show. His iconic number, according to the press release, 3 with the word Buddy in a diamond, will be featured on the sleeve of the Mets home and road jersey. Harrelson's 6 grandchildren will be involved in the ceremonial first pitches on opening day. Your thoughts?
It's the right thing to do, and I applaud the Mets for doing the right thing by Buddy Harrelson. I was doing some research on, no, I don't think this was research. I think I just came across it on articles regarding Buddy Harrelson's trade to the Phillies in spring training of 1978. I remember what it was like to be a Mets fan in those days, so I'm not surprised that Buddy's quotes were, "Finally, I couldn't wait for this to happen. I'm so glad to get out of here. I'm so happy to be going to the Phillies. They're a really good team." And it's like, oh yeah, that's right. Buddy Harrelson wasn't always a Met, and Buddy Harrelson was happy to not be a Met for a little while. But he came home eventually. And even though he left the organization at some point, they fired him, for God's sake, as a manager. And he went on and founded the Long Island Ducks, all the stuff we talked about earlier in the winter. He's always a Met and one of the quintessential Mets. And I'm not surprised that they did this. They've done this for Gary Carter when he passed too soon, Ralph Kiner when he died, Tom Seaver a couple of years ago, Tug McGraw, Bob Murphy, Rusty Staub. So he's on that level. He is one of the core Mets of not only his time, but of all time. And I'm glad he's going to be on the sleeve, be in our consciousness for the rest of the season. I see where, his family will be there on opening day. And, I hope they feel the warmth from the fans, regardless of wind chills and everything else. Nice move on the Mets' part. And I wouldn't expect anything less, to be honest.
I agree completely. And I think our listeners are anxious to hear our predictions for the season. Greg, you're not big on predictions the way I am.
No, I don't have, what it is? I don't have the data. I don't feel confident in saying they're going to go this many wins and this many losses, especially now playing 29 different teams. So I'll let you do the specific predicting, and I'll throw in a few thoughts.
And not having the data is not going to stop me from making predictions such as I did last year when I said the Mets were going to win the World Series. Just give me one, Greg. The DraftKings over and under. And by the way, DraftKings is not a sponsor. I just like their app. If DraftKings or any of the other betting apps wants to sponsor, feel free. The show operates at a deficit. Feel free. And Greg will write ad copy for you that will make Don Draper cry.
Same, by the way, for Mama's Empanadas, who I gave a free plug to.
But did the
If
rum go with the Mama's Empanadas?
I would think the rum, if it's afternoon and it was a few minutes before noon, I think it would go with anything.
Hey, so the DraftKings over and under is 81 and a half. Do you think they'll win more than 81 and a half games?
Well, I think that is a critical number, not because of DraftKings, but that's the difference between a winning season and not having a winning season. So I feel more comfortable talking in vague generalities. Are the Mets a winning team? They can be if I'm walking by the DraftKings counter or the sports book, whatever the hell it is DraftKings has. I guess it's all virtual. I don't know. There's a Caesars sports book at Citi Field, by the way. That's where they had all the food out. The Shohei Ohtani interpreter story had just broken. I was thinking, hey, he could have just come here, saved himself a lot of grief. I assume this is legal. Anyway, it would be a downer to sit here on the eve of a new season and say the Mets can't have a winning record. So I suddenly found a couple of dollars on the street and the DraftKings storefront, if you will, were in front of me. Come on, what are you going to do? Over, under? Hey, put me down as an over. Don't hold me to it. But if you're taking my $2, sure. Let's win at least 82 games this year. Let's be optimistic as that far as that goes.
I have over on that also. I think they'll get to 85 wins as follows: Braves, Phillies, Mets, Marlins, Washington, 1 through 5 in the NL East. My prediction is that we get toward the trade deadline and the Mets are 1 or 2 over .500. They're hovering. They're in a big pack for the second and third wild card. Phillies separated themselves for the top wild card, but the Mets are in a pack with Arizona, San Francisco, San Diego, maybe others, for the second and third wild cards. What will Steve Cohen do? What will David Stearns do? That's the big question. What will they do? Will they stand pat? Will they do what they did last year? Will they trade Pete Alonso, as was predicted in Monday's The Athletic? Or will they go for it? Steve Cohen said that he wants to be opportunistic. The New York Post will have a bad photo illustration of Steve Cohen as a contestant on Deal or No Deal, standing next to Howie Mandel, and David Stearns will be the suitcase model with two suitcases, Deal, No Deal, and Steve Cohen will be standing there with a baseball cap. He makes trades. He authorizes trades. The Mets go for it. The Mets make the playoffs with 85 wins. The Mets are in the third wild card spot, which is the sweet spot, because then they play the NL Central champion. All the games will be on the road. They'll be playing the Cubs, Cardinals, whoever, Reds. But they win that series while Philadelphia and Arizona or San Diego are battling it out in the 1 and 2 wild card. The Mets win their first playoff series in so many years. We're happy until they play the Dodgers. Then they lose to the Dodgers. We say, okay, this was a good stepping stone. We'll take it. That's how far the Mets go.
Thank you for joining us on National League Town for 2024. You now know how it works out. You don't have to listen. You don't have to watch. Everything is handled here. And the New York Post, be sure to compensate my partner here for your graphics. They will fit very nicely with your various jingoisms and yellow journalisms. Sure, sounds good. I think the one thing in this that I think raises an interesting point, if this does come to pass, this opportunistic interval that might happen, is this going to be a situation where you can picture or you would even endorse trading one of the good-looking young players that we're now building our hopes around for constant contention, for sustained excellence, which I think has been what they've been talking about, what we all kind of want to experience. One of maybe not the absolute blue chips you got last year, but one of these pitchers who you saw during spring training, one of the younger players. Is this something, unless it's, we'll just take somebody's salary off somebody's hands because Steve Cohen can do that. For a team that feels like it's on the verge of maybe getting to 85 wins when we're in late July. And again, this is all speculative. So, but you've just worked out the whole season, so I might as well join your world for a moment. How all in should the Mets be where it becomes we're willing to trade to use from the last time the Mets won a postseason series? We're willing to trade Michael Fulmer, a future rookie of the year, to get, I don't know if we're going to get Yoenis Cespedes, the 2024 version of him, but where we trade a blue chip prospect to get somebody who could just get us into the playoffs.
That's going to be a big question, because will Steve undo last year's trades? He traded big names to acquire big prospects. What happens this year if a team that's in the same situation as the Mets were last year says, we'll give you the pitcher you need. We will give you the pitcher that can get you through the playoffs, but you have to trade us Luis Angel Acuña. Are they going to do that? Is that a step backwards? I don't know. I think the trade level may be at the line of like Mike Vassell, who is considered to be a good prospect, but not a blue chipper. I don't know if they're going to go that far. Do you?
I somehow can't picture Cunha, somebody at that level, but maybe one of those two very young guys they got from the Marlins. One of their, what feels like their surfeit of shortstop prospects. When you have Jet Williams and you have, by the way, Francisco Lindor. When you start to have a surplus of prospects where you're feeling pretty good about your depth. Remember, that's how the 1984 Mets became the 1985 Mets, became the 1986 Mets, because you had a stocked farm system, some of whom became world champion Mets, some of whom became Montreal Expos or Boston Red Sox, so you could get the players who put us over the top. Again, that's baseball, as they say. That's always a challenge. Every fan base loves prospects, especially when things aren't going well or haven't been going well. Just you wait till these guys get up here. Just wait till they grow in to being real major leaguers. You know, there was a time where it hurt to trade Jared Kelnick. I don't know if it'll still feel that way a year from now after he does whatever he does for the Atlanta Braves, if he does anything for the Atlanta Braves. But that will be a Rubicon to cross in July if we get to the scenario that you were so kind as to lay out. We may very well be in a situation where either A, we're not really near a playoff spot, so doesn't matter, or B, we're really doing well and we don't have to make that move. We certainly don't have to make a move that would cost us a jewel. So this is the beauty of a new season. We don't know, and we're going to find out. And at some point, it will have happened, and we can reflect on it. Broadly speaking, what you described, 85 wins and a chance to step it up and do something in the playoffs, I think that's possible. Sure. I think it's possible that that won't happen. And I think there's a tiny chance that everything great happens, because there's always a tiny chance everything great happens, because what did your friend Tom Boswell say? Time begins on opening day.
Some more predictions. Pete's home run total is projected 42 and a half. I say over. Hopefully he hits all of those as a member of the Mets. His RBI total, 108 and a half. I say over. My semi-bold prediction is almost tepid. Francisco Alvarez, who I drafted in fantasy, by the way, hits more than 30 home runs. I say it's almost tepid, not even semi-bold, because he had 25 last year. I say he goes over 30. And my bold prediction, speaking of the trades they made last year, Drew Gilbert gets called up and he shines and never gets sent back down. Any thoughts on those?
I'm all for Pete hitting home runs. I'm all for Alvarez hitting home runs. I'm all for Drew Gilbert making his debut and making it difficult to send him down. Here's a prediction-ish. Pitching's going to be okay. Starting pitching's going to be okay. It's not going to be great, maybe. There'll be days where it looks good. There'll be days where we're fooled to thinking it's fantastic. But this is a, strikes me, what a little I saw and little I followed during spring training and just on track records and perhaps some health issues being resolved. This strikes me as a professional starting rotation, which may be just kind of a nice way of saying there are no real stars aligned. But I don't hate this group. I'm willing to ride with a guy who's been a bit of a punching bag for both of us, Tyler McGill. I want to believe that this is the one, this is the year where he's no longer a guy who gets set aside. Like what Severino has done. I'm going to forget where he used to pitch. Like Minaya. Not sure about Hauser yet, but he'll get a shot. Quintana was my guy last summer. A little less convinced about him right now, but I think he is a sensible opening day starter. Did I name all five of them? I hope I did. I think they're going to be okay.
Yeah, that's something that struck me during the spring training. First week of spring training, the starters are going two innings, pitching well. And by the end, they were pitching five innings, and they're pitching well. That was a consistent pattern in spring training, and I agree with you about the pitching. Speaking of pitching, before we go, a Mets pitcher from the 1969 World Champion Mets passed away at the age of 80. We remember Jim McAndrew.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff. Jim McAndrew left us recently. You talk about pitching depth. You talk about wanting to be ready for anything, and you talk about world champions. Jim McAndrew evokes all of that. Jim McAndrew was, in the parlance of baseball, fourth starter, fifth starter, swing man a little bit. 1968 to 1973, that encompasses two very memorable years in Mets history, which Jim McAndrew was an essential part of. 1969, the night the Mets go into first place. If Jim McAndrew had never done anything else. Jim McAndrew pitched 11 innings. 11 innings. Who pitches 11 innings? It wasn't even that common in 1869. It wasn't totally unheard of, but Jim McAndrew, you know, he wasn't Tom Seaver, Jerry Guzman, but he might as well have been that September night against the Montreal Expos, where he kept the game tied at two and the Mets put the winning run across in the 12th after McAndrew has been relieved. They go percentage points ahead of the Cubs and they win the second game. This is the first game of a twi-night doubleheader, and they're never not the first place Mets again. You know, we have lived as Mets fans with so many great pitchers who we're convinced are never going to get a win when they deserve one. We lived that situation with Jacob deGrom for several years. We saw it with Tom Seaver in our youth. I remember there was like a solid month where Pedro Martinez was fabulous in 2006 and could not get a win. Jim McAndrew didn't invent that. Go back for fun, folks. Go back, look at his pitching logs on Baseball Reference for 1968. You'll see a guy who's giving up basically no runs as soon as he's called up from the minor leagues, and he's 0-5 despite an ERA in the low twos, like one outing, and the rest are sterling and brilliant and beautiful. Year of the pitcher notwithstanding. If it was the year of the pitcher, it was the year of Jim McAndrew. What did Jim McAndrew have to do to get on the board in those days when what mattered was your one lost record? He had to beat Steve Carlton, young then, but a future Hall of Famer. He had to beat Steve Carlton and the Cardinals, 1-0. And he had to beat Ferguson Jenkins and the Cubs, a very good team in those days, 1-0. 1-0 wins. One was a complete game shutout. One he took into the ninth inning, got a little relief help. You talk about perseverance as sort of a rite of initiation. Jim McAndrews had all that. And again, on a staff that is remembered for Seaver and Guzman and Gary Gentry and Nolan Ryan and Don Cardwell, who was the veteran of that group, Jim McAndrew is just like an incredible extra weapon to have. And more than just, oh yeah, we have another guy. I mean, he was somebody Gil Hodges relied on. 69 going forward, you know, I hear the name Jim McAndrew and I'm 7 years old again, to be honest. There's certain players from when I'm first immersing myself in the Mets and immersing myself in baseball who I'll always just see in that guise. We'll always see them on Channel 9 and see their pictures in the yearbook in my mind and see their names in those lines in the Sunday papers where you have the long list of every pitcher in each league. And there was McAndrew, NY, and I was always excited when he got in there, had enough decisions. And at one really good, everything worked for him season in 72, winning record, low ERA, Yogi Berra relying on him, did a good stretch as a New York Met. One oddity is a part of both postseason teams in those years, made the postseason roster in both of those years, never pitched in the postseason. The Mets went a lot further, a lot deeper with their starting pitchers in those days. Tom Seaver once pitched a 10-inning game. Jerry Guzman pitched complete games. John Matlack in 73 pitching a shutout. So just by the luck of the draw, Jim McAndrew never got into a playoff game or a World Series game, but he got the ring, 69, and he deserved it. He got whatever ring they gave out for being league champion 73, deserved that. Traded to the Padres after that, pitched for them a little bit, and his major league career ended shortly thereafter. Always around, though, when the times came where you wanted to get together with your 1969 and 1973 Mets, a staple of reunions. Wasn't at the last old-timers game, but I remember seeing him as a kid in those old-timers days. Whenever you'd read an article, what are they up to now? You found out he was living back in the Midwest, later Arizona. I think if you ever lived a Jim McAndrew start and Bob Murphy was doing the game, you knew where Jim McAndrew was from. He was a citizen of Lost Nation, Iowa. Would you know about Lost Nation, Iowa, if it wasn't for Jim McAndrew? Probably not. Final thing I remember was talking to a guy who, big time collector of Mets stuff years ago. And he was just kind of telling me this and that. And he says, Yeah, and I had breakfast with Jim McAndrew at the World Series in 2015 in Kansas City. Like I said, Jim McAndrew was there. He said, yeah. I said, like, and he just came on his own. Like, yeah, that's just how Jim McAndrew was. He still cared about the Mets, still loved the Mets. And somebody else, a friend of mine, confirmed this that this is Jim McAndrew, very much a New York Met in his soul and in his, shall we say, baseball afterlife. And if I'm not mistaken, you have a little Jim McAndrew interaction in your life.
I went to fantasy camp in 2009 and he was there along with his son, and he was a gentleman, and it was a thrill meeting him. He signed the autographs and he was one of the coaches, and it was a thrill meeting a member of the 1969 champion Mets.
How did it work with autographs at fantasy camp? Like, they're your coaches, they're sort of your teammates, and then, they are who they are to you. Like, at what point do you go up to somebody and ask for an autograph?
I don't know how they do it today, but then they said, just wait, we'll take care of you. And they gave us a bat and a ball with everybody's signature on it. So it was planned, and they did that at the end.
I guess it's not like they didn't think somebody was going to want an autograph, but I suppose it would have been kind of would have held up the works if okay, here's how you grip the baseball. Can I have your autograph, Mr. McAndrew? But that sounds like a, well, again, you've told me about your fantasy camp experience. Hey, if you're sitting there, it's raining on Thursday. You know what you should do? Go to the Faith and Fear archives. Go to January 2009. Read Jeff's experiences. He was kind enough to share them with our readers way back when. And I go back and read them occasionally, and it warms my heart. And I'm so glad you had that experience. I'm so glad Jim McAndrew was a part of that experience. Because, what? That's 40 years after 1969, 35 years after he retired from baseball, to know that you had that melange, shall we say, of players from all eras. Which was what I thought made the last Alzheimer's Day such a magical thing, that you got to, see not only guys who you had watched probably 5 years before, you were seeing guys, from your childhood, from your adolescence, and guys who won a World Series for us. We never forget those guys. And sorry that 80 is a good long run, to be sure, but sorry he's gone. And appreciates that he made himself available to us in so many ways. So thank you, Jim McAndrew. Thank you to his family, and may all go well for you.
Thank you, Greg, for your beautiful words. Our condolences to Jim McAndrew's family and friends. May his memory be a blessing. And that'll do it for this episode of National League Town. We will be here as events warrant sporadically. So if the Mets win their first six, we'll have a show. Greg, you said that's a record if they win their first six.
In 1985, the Mets got off to a 5-0 start. That is the existing record. They never did it before, and they haven't done it since. So sure, the Mets are 6-0, and we're losing our minds enough to shout out the window our exuberance over this powerhouse 2024 Mets club. We'll channel some of that into a microphone for you, and we'd be most obliged that you tuned in.
Subscribe to National League Town to make sure you don't miss an episode. So until next time, I'm Jeff Heisen.
I'm Greg Prince.
And as always, let's go Mets! Copyright 2024, music provided by the Royal Arctic Institute. Check them out on Spotify.